I'm Kilowatt 2, Romeo, India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll also hear Mel, Kilo 2, Kilo Romeo. Mel and Dick try to act as hosts, interlocutors, net control, whatever, for the technical net. We claim this is a new, improved technical net, where during the first hour, most of the people who sign in will get at least a preliminary answer. We try not to give the long answers during the first hour. The main subject that's discussed on any of the tech nets are the subjects that you guys bring as questions or comments as to what's the latest in ham radio in your particular QTH, your environment. After the first hour, or if we end a little bit early on the preliminary questions to people's answers to people's questions, Mel opens his mailbag because there's quite a number of amateurs who have discovered the tech net, discovered that they like ham radio and they want to get into it, and so they don't yet have access to on-air live communication. That's what the majority of the tech net is, on-air give and take between let me drop. It's an on-air give and take between the people who have questions, and usually there's a significant staff of people in the New Jersey and Connecticut areas that this particular repeater covers, where quite often someone in that area has experience in that particular subject, and he'll give us the benefit of his experience. Beyond the first hour and a fraction, when we do the preliminary questions and the mailbag section, if Paul, WS2N, has a space report, we go to that. And after that, we dig into more deep subjects. For the last few months, you probably know a significant number of people have, not everybody likes this subject, but some people really want to know at the atomic level what is taking place. Where is the magnetic field really coming from? Where is a magnetic field coming from? What constitutes magnetism? We're trying to find out what Mother Nature is telling us, because within a certain percentage of ham radio operators, there really is a kind of a scientist asking these questions and trying to figure out how it all works. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A sign-in might sound like this, WS2N, Paul, and yes. So give me your call letters, your name, and that yes at the time that you want to be signed in. KQRIW.
KT2RJW. Joe, yes.
Very fine. We got Joe, RJW. Anyone else?
81, Victor Delta Bravo. Lewis.
Got you.
WS2N, Paul, with the space report. Good evening, Dick.
Okay. We've got Lewis. We got Paul. Anyone else?
KC2TZG.
KC2. It sounds like Tango Golf. Tango Charlie Golf. And if you're signing in with a question, sir, correct me on your call letters and please tell me your name.
Yes, this is Kilo Charlie 2, Tango Zulu Golf. Name here is Joe.
Okay, Joe, you're on the list. Let's see if I got the numbers correctly here. Alrighty, anyone else to sign in? Give me your call letters right now.
Alpha Echo, just monitoring.
Very fine, Charlie Sierra. Anyone else?
Hello, Charlie 2, Papa Uniform.
And Mr. Papa Uniform Yankee, what is your name, sir?
Sam, your Alpha Mike, Sam.
We got you, Sam. And one last call, anyone else to check in tonight? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
K2KY, I have to say something to begin with, Dick.
N2MB, I got nothing to say. Good evening, Dick. Good evening, everybody on the net. N2MB.
That's you, Barry, and go right ahead, Mel.
Okay, this is KTKEY 6. I've been inundated. It's a, I guess, being a conservative word to say. I've got emails here coming, phone calls coming. The 10 meter net today. Again, I will make a statement. Dick and I are not on the board of directors of Limark. We do not have policy for Limark. I'm saying this for myself, and I believe Dick will confirm this. Not do anything other than tell you that we are the TechNet people. The governing board of Limark. I think I'm speaking to you. If not, please correct me.
Yes. Mel and I, one way of looking at it is we think we're providing a service. In other words, we provide a forum by which people from the tri-state area, where there's an awful lot of brain power, come together, and amateurs help each other. We're not directly connected with the officers or board of directors or whatever of Limark itself. For us, they own us a machine on these evenings. Well, roughly 1982, this is TechNet number 1,339. September of 1982, so it's been going on for a very long period of time. Mel and I make an attempt to stay out of the politics of ham radio. Yes, when it comes to somebody taking away some of our, threatening to take away some of our frequencies, we certainly express our opinions. So, what made you feel that there was some form of controversy? In other words, of those people who were getting on the 10-meter net or emailing you, what seemed to be their teaching, you know what I mean, ML, KQLIW?
Well, it's a discussion business that Limark repeater is going to be a closed repeater, and they feel that they don't own the frequency, and I got the whole routine today. They don't own the frequency, and they boycott them, and all kinds of things, and I just have no answer. I mean, I have no answer to any of this. The same thing with the emails. Hopefully, the people on the email says they'll never see us. They want us at their hand fest to send money and all. Well, we're not going to do it. In fact, we're going to boycott and advise everybody, stay away. On and on and on. And I mean, I got literally 75 or more of these emails, Dick, plus the number of phone calls. How dare you? I says, I don't dare nothing. I don't know how I can excuse you as making this policy, Dick, over.
KGK, as you did.
Yeah, this is the president of the club. Rich, go right ahead, Rich.
All right. First of all, I'm completely acceptable to anyone who wants to contact me by the email at khkmb@limark.org or my telephone number. We're up on the website. But this is a problem when people don't know rules and regulations and continue to harp on something. They obviously don't understand repeater frequencies. May not be owned, but they are run as computer operators. And that's the bottom line. We need to know. Limark, throughout the country, they are not what we call it. You have to be a member to use the repeater on a regular basis. There are closed repeaters that really set definitions. And that's it, Dick. These are people who obviously don't know the rules and regulations regarding repeaters, and just that's part of the problem that Limark has. We do set rules. People don't like it, but they're really not informed about what repeaters are, and maybe one night you'll spend a lesson on that.
Yeah, I've got a couple of opinions on this one. No one owns the frequency 146,000. Fox 98.5. It's used by the Frenchtown repeater in New Jersey. It's used by the Torrington repeater in Connecticut, and it's used by the Limonk repeater in Long Island. And the frequency advisory board, the local repeater advisory board, dedicates who in each area has authorization to use that particular frequency. They don't own it. They do own a piece of hardware. The actual repeater hardware itself is a transmitter, a receiver, a site, a rental on a site, and whatever. And the board of directors and the officers of that repeater, the people who own that piece of hardware, do have the right, as I understand it, to say, I would rather this particular person who uses obscene language not use our particular piece of hardware. I would rather that the people who are going to use it very frequently should become members and should support it. So that's one way of looking at it. I wonder if I've got it right or wrong now, Rich. K2KNB, K2RIW.
Yes, I believe that's a fair appraisal of it. We have an organization which has been given the coordinated frequency, the organization which coordinates. In our bylaws, it says that we will own and operate these things for the use of members. There's nothing wrong with that, and the FCC recognizes that where there are costs involved in running a repeater, and as I've stated, the reason why people are listening on this repeater is that we spend money for our sites, which other clubs don't. They may have a free site in a tower or a church, whatever the case may be. We spend a lot of money to maintain our site, and the FCC fully recognizes that those organizations that spend money can charge for the use of the repeater, and furthermore, that they can limit, as Dick said, the use of the repeater. But the problem is when people speak without really knowing what the rules and regulations are, that just makes no sense to me. And to speak to a third party, I'm fully accessible. I get phone calls all the time. Give me a call if you'd like an explanation. Drop me an email if you'd like an explanation, and let's talk it out instead of having this rancor going on all the time. Dick?
One more thing, K-E-Y.
Go ahead, Mel.
The crux of it is the way it's done on the air. This is what it's come down to. In fact, I had that this morning on the 10-meter net, that they are actually been insulted on the air. These people are telling me and told, get off. In fact, one of them was a young person, barely knew the ham radio, didn't realize that he had gotten on there a number of times, kept being enthusiastic, and he says, well, what they said to him, that literally you either have to tell members of your club that they have no right to threaten people on the air with FCC action unless you are a member of the, or pay for the membership of the use of this repeater. I've got, I'd say 24 complaints of that right here, Dick. Substantiated complaints, over.
One of them, pass it over to Rich. We got to be careful now about being judgmental. By that I mean, occasionally a person, who maybe is not an officer, maybe is not a real representative of the club, not a board member, not an officer, but somehow feels that he is empowered, and he makes some very strong statements. And I know of one particular circumstance where a person, without authorization, made a very strong statement to youngsters and scared the living daylights out of them, and that really wasn't proper. And Rich did his best to correct that particular situation. So when someone makes a strong statement, evaluate the source. Is that really an officer? Is that really a board of a director? Or is it just simply a person flexing his muscles as he uses the repeater and it's not authorized? Rich, K2KNB, K2RIW.
Dick, one more thing.
Yeah, go ahead, Mel.
A few years ago, I had somebody that was the officer of Limark do it to me. Sent me even a paper explaining his position that he was some kind of recruiter for Limark. You want his call letters and his name? I'm not ashamed to give it, because he wasn't. And he threatened me on the air in front of a number of people. In fact, a number of people from Limark that heard it called me to apologize, including that time the president of Limark, who was Diane Ortiz at the time, K2DO, over.
Yeah, we all make mistakes. I'd like to believe that that was a mistake. I'm going to give it over to Rich for an explanation of that. This is a hobby. We're supposed to enjoy it. Try to be kind to each other. K2KMD, go ahead, Rich.
And this is K2KMD. First of all, there is no one who is authorized to speak for Limark other than actually the officers. I would even say the board, the directors, rarely get involved in anything on the air. But the officers would be the only ones who would ever say anything. And the trustee, of course, because ultimately a lot comes back onto the trustee. Part of the problem is, as Dick said, things happened 10 years ago. And I would say that things have changed dramatically in 10 years. And yet there's always people who think that they're speaking for a club or an organization, and they say things that don't make any sense or really are unfair. But in the time that I've been listening on this repeater, I mean, yes, I did hear that once out of one person, and it was incorrect and told that that's just not the way you do something. But other than that, I have never heard anyone told that they must leave the repeater because they are not a member of Limark. We try to be as gentle as possible. We remind people that they should be joining, but I have never heard anyone make the kinds of comments, Mel, that you said. And your incident was 10 years ago. And it's just not fair. You've got to be able to move on at some point. Dick?
Yeah, let me give Mel one more chance to say something on this one, Mel. Go ahead, Mel.
Oh, it's true. It was 10 years ago. You're 100% right, Rich, and I'm sure things have changed. I was just giving you an example at the time that it did happen, so I know firsthand what it's like to experience that. And I don't think that I would be getting these emails from people that haven't experienced it. It actually, in actuality, they told me today, I got their call letter of one person that's willing to stand up and say he experienced it directly. And Steve had told me this morning, he said, you can mention that I had that experience. So this is the only thing I can go by is what I am getting here in emails. I can say I've got 75 emails here with a number of these comments. That's about all I could say on it, and I wish they would direct it towards Limark, and I am not, again, nor Dick, the authority that is, of course, responsible or in any way for the operation, like I say, of Limark and its club. Over.
Okay, I think we've dwelled long enough tonight. I usually try to promise people that we're not going to have very much politics, and hopefully that wasn't politics. Joe, KC2, Romeo, Juliet, Whiskey. What would you like to talk about tonight, ham radio-wise, K2RIW? You got it, Joe.
Yeah, thanks, Dick. KC2RJW. I installed a dipole in my attic. I took on dipole. Multi-band dipole. Now I've noticed that the touch lamps in my bedroom are going on as I broadcast KC2RJW.
Yeah, Joe is a little bit weak on the input, but I'm hearing him very well. He's a little bit weak through the machine, but I'm hearing very well on the input. So I'll repeat that question. His dipole in the attic, when he transmits, his touch controlled lamps in the house are now going on and off. And we've heard of that one before. You could call it electromagnetic interference, Joe. These touch lamps really are a proximity detector. In other words, most of these touch-controlled devices, when you look at the schematic diagram, one of their popular frequencies is 100 kilohertz. In other words, there's an oscillator in there running at roughly 100 kilohertz. You put your finger near or on the metal plate, that's the so-called touch plate, the capacitance of your body is sensed, or the capacitance changes that 100 KC oscillator to, let's say, 90 KC. There's various ways that these detecting devices operate by sensing the capacitance of your body with something like a 100 KC oscillator in that lamp. And so in some cases, your hand is loading down the circuit. It senses the difference in amplitude, a little bit like a grid dip meter. Let me drop. And any RF energy getting in there from your dipole being picked up by that metal plate gets rectified and becomes a phony signal, and either a phony signal for you touching it or a phony signal that you have just stopped touching it, if you know what I mean. The circuit becomes false alarmed, we can say. A number of people have run into that problem, and it's not an easy one to solve. Rearranging where your dipole is located, I know you don't have that option, but that would be one great one, creating a greater separation between the dipole if it was outside. You've obviously put it inside your attic because you don't want it outside because you're afraid that it will be viewed by other people or the wife, or maybe there's a restriction on your particular location, Joe. When it comes to another method by which it could be false alarmed, the power cord that's plugged into the wall could be a way that the radio energy is being picked up and aggravating the circuit. So these ferrite devices you can buy at Radio Shack, and I hope Radio Shack in your neighborhood is still selling them. If not, you'll have to go to another Radio Shack. But they sell these black ferrite clamshell-like devices that you can put over the power cord or wrap the power cord through it. So the power cord now has an RF choke and it acts less as an antenna. I'd recommend that. When it comes to putting in bypass capacitors inside, because it is generally, let me drop it, because it is an RF circuit, you can't normally bypass. When it comes to a telephone picking up radio energy, because the telephone only has to work at voice frequencies, you can put a bypass capacitor, which has no reaction to voice, but a lot of reaction to RF, because there's a huge difference in the frequency ranges. In your particular case, you don't have that a bigger frequency range between the 100 KC and the real radio energy you're working through. So try coiling the cord, making a coil out of it. If you've got extra cord left over, coiling it and taping it together or putting it together with a tie wrap is the beginning. These ferrite devices to stop the cord from becoming an antenna, and mount the ferrite device as close to the lamp as possible. These are some of my suggestions. Let's see if anyone else on frequency has run into it and has found a solution. If so, give me a call. Let us right now if your touch lamp used to give you a false alarm with your radio signals. K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2KEY.
Mal recognized. Anyone else? Okay, let's see what the guys in the Kings County Radio Club do to solve that problem. Mel's the former president of that club. Go right ahead, Mel.
Roger. Well, you see, this problem I've had with a number of different devices. And the crux of the problem is that the devices have absolutely no shielding. And, of course, the way things are made, especially today, coming in from you know where, they're in little plastic, cheap little plastic boxes. So it don't take much. There is for an RF signal that's adjacent or, you know, in the locality to get into these boxes. In many cases, just wrapping them, believe it or not, in tin foil makes a difference. I know in a lamp, you know, that's going to be a bit of a problem, but if you go inside and you look at it, everything just sits on a little cheap printed circuit board most likely surface mounted technology, and of course any RF signal that's present locally is easily going to get into that device, and there's little or nothing. Yes, maybe I could say wrapping the cord with one of those cores may help, but in many cases, Dick, it just can't solve it simply because of the design. Over.
Okay. I think if you stop the power cord going into the wall from becoming an antenna by choking it, either physically or with these ferrite devices, that's one approach. Mel is recommending that you could, if you want to, take apart the device and line the inside of the box with tinfoil. Got to be careful now that tinfoil doesn't create a phony short circuit. Not an easy one, Joe, but I think it is solvable. Back to you. And by the way, Joe, if you do find a solution, please come back and tell us whether it was successful or unsuccessful. Tell us what you found. When I pass it back to you, Joe, wait until you hear the beeps. KC2RJB. RJW. K2RIW in the deck now.
W. Guys, the detrimental effect from the antennas on the human body. KC2RJW.
Yeah, that's a good question, Joe. You're now talking about what's called radio frequency biohazard. And just because the lamp is affected, just because an inexpensively made telephone or a phonograph or a tape recorder might be affected, it's easy to think that the radio energy is potentially doing something to your body. Very, very unlikely. If you were running a full gallon, 1,500 watts, into your dipole antenna, and if you stood right at the center of that antenna, 1 foot away from it, and you do the calculation, you probably are getting close to the threshold of alarm, but as you back away from that antenna, every time you double the distance between you and it, the total amount of radio energy getting to you becomes smaller and smaller. On top of that, when you study the reports by American National Standards Institute, they'll show you a curve of how many watts per square centimeter or how many volts per meter. There's various units for measurement. But as you get down to the HF frequencies, it becomes safer and safer. In other words, the radio energy at lower frequencies goes right through you and does nothing. When you get above 30 megacycles, 30 to 300 megacycles, is a frequency region where the body does absorb a high percentage of the radio energy, and then you make a quick calculation as to whether or not the extra heating it creates will give you grief. As you study it a little bit further, Joe, you're going to discover that you've got to really make two or three errors in a row to get yourself in trouble with radio energy. Tremendous amount of power, 6 minutes also. There's a time limit in there. In other words, the heating of a body part, which maybe could create some grief, takes 6 minutes to do it. Most of your body parts have got 6 minutes of time constant. So keep
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
So to repeat what I'm saying is that if you ran 1,500 watts into the antenna, key down for 6 solid minutes, and you stood 1 foot away from the antenna, I'm reasonably sure you'd be coming close to the threshold of grief. I know that you're not doing either one of those things. You're nowhere near that close. You're probably not radiating that much power, and you don't put the key down for 6 solid minutes. So I'm reasonably sure that you'd have to do a couple of really crazy things to get yourself in trouble. Does that make some sense, Joe? Back to you, Joe. Wait for the beep. K2RIW.
KC2RJW. Yeah, Dick, that makes sense. I was on 10 today, and I'm only running 100 watts, so I don't see any problem. Thank you. KC2RJW.
When you do get a chance to work on those touch lamps, Joe, and if you do have success or failure, please come back and tell us because there's people listening who probably also have some touch lamps, and they'd like to know what the guys in Bayside do to make the problem go away. That's where Joe lives. Okay, Lewis was the next person. Kilo Bravo 1, Victor Delta Bravo. Go ahead, Lewis. KQRIW, my name is Dick.
KB1, VDB. Yeah, Dick, I had a question for you. I think I know some of the answers, but I'd definitely love to hear your input on it. My question is regarding propagation. In terms of, say there's an island that's 2.5 miles by 1 mile, fairly well covered in trees, what's better to use, VHF or UHF, in terms of getting propagation from, you know, an antenna on a roof to someone else on the island that is outdoors? So I'm curious to know about generally which is better, VHF or UHF, in that situation, and also, you know, how do trees affect the propagation? Obviously they absorb, but, you know, how does it affect differently, VHF versus UHF? Let me know if you have any additional questions regarding that. Thanks.
Yeah, very fine, Lou. I got one very interesting question first. Where are you located right now? Because your address is listed as Maine. Back to you, Lou.
KB1, VDB, /W2, I should have added that. I am currently located in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, but I am heading up to that address that you can look up. And if you look that up on Google Maps, you'll see the island I'm talking about, to give you an idea of the general landscape of the island.
Yes, I'm seeing that map right now. Isles Ford, Maine. Wow. Beautiful looking location. Now, which would be the best? VHF, UHF, what a tree is doing and whatever? There's no simple answer to this one. Maybe what you're trying to decide is which portion of ham radio you should establish first. Because each has its advantages and disadvantages, you're going to get a lot of fun on the VHF frequencies, you're going to get a lot of fun on the HF frequencies. If I were you, I would do it all. Just your biggest decision, Joe, is to which, I mean, Lou, is decide which one you're going to do first. In the case of HF, 80 through 10 meters, trees give you only a small amount of blockage. In other words, a tree is a vertically polarized object. Most of the time, guys use horizontal polarization on HF frequencies. And the cross-polarization is such that the trees are reasonably transparent. Not perfectly transparent. When there's a lot of foliage on the trees and there's rain on those leaves in the summertime, a 10-meter signal without a doubt is going to be attenuated. As you go to higher and higher frequencies, 6 meters, 2 meters, 432, 1296, the trees rapidly become more and more absorptive. And as such, your antennas that clear the trees in the summertime are going to be a hell of a lot more effective on the VHF and UHF frequencies. So setting up a tower that allows your antennas to get above the trees will give you a tremendous increase in performance. Let me drop. But with the right kind of antennas on that kind of a QTH, you probably are in a grid square. Let me see, which grid square are you in? I think it tells me here. Fox November 54. Wow. I think that's one of the rather rare grid squares. You're going to be a popular fellow on VHF during the VHF contest. So I would do it all. The HF antennas, a little bit of altitude helps, but it's not as demanding as it is on VHF frequencies. But on VHF frequencies, you would really like the antennas to clear the trees. I used to keep accurate signal reports of the guys on 432, and I could easily tell in the summertime that between summer and winter, the signals would change by a 100-to-1 ratio, 20 decibels of difference, because the foliage on the trees, if their antennas were below the trees, gave them great attenuation. For the guys whose antennas were on a tower above the trees, they sounded almost the same summer, winter, spring, and fall. That was some of my experience there. Maybe that helps, Joe, and if you got further questions, go right ahead. KB1, Victor Delta Bravo. What a QTH you got. H2RIW in the TechNet.
KB1VB, yeah, I'm excited to go up there. I haven't done anything on HF yet, just got my license, tech license in January, and at the Hamfest I got my general license, so definitely excited to do some HF, but in terms of local communication, I was, you know, going to do a VHF or UHF, you know, antenna on the roof, and it could be possible that I can get above the trees, although probably initially I won't do that. I'll just put it on top of the house, which the trees are still maybe easily 20, 30, 40 feet higher than that. So I was curious as to if I had to choose, I mean, obviously I'm going to experiment, but if I had to choose, you know, would you recommend broadcasting on VHF, not broadcasting, but communicating on VHF or UHF? I presume VHF will have a better pass through the trees a bit, you know, in terms of distance. Is that correct?
KC2MDP.
Steve recognized. I'm going to turn it over to Steve in a minute. KC2MDP. Do it all. On HF, I think you're going to get out of your own backyard a little bit better. On VHF, the fact that you might at first put the VHF antenna on the chimney of the house 20 feet below the tops of the trees is going to give you some attenuation. It's not a showstopper. Depending on whether or not the other VHF guys within the nearest 20 or 30 miles of you is going to determine how many people you talk to. If you get on a VHF frequency, 6.2 or 432, for instance, 6 meters, 2 meters, or 432, and the band seems kind of dead to you during a contest, don't judge that as you've got a poor location. You just have a poor location for the antenna. Depending on what the layout is, how close in miles are the nearest hams and how much power they run, you might do very well with an antenna around the chimney. But don't bail out on a band just because the band seems dead to you with a VHF antenna on the chimney. Whereas the HF antennas, where you could string them through the trees are beautiful, natural resources to be used for supporting many kinds of antennas, dipoles and beverages and vertical dipoles and horizontal dipoles and inverted bees and so on. Trees are beautiful supports. Let's see what Steve's got to recommend. KC2MDP, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. Now, it's got nothing to do with the topic on hand. I just want to bring it to the attention to the powers that be. I'm getting a 140, I think it's 140, what is it, 141, 143, I forget now. I just looked on the radio. PL on the output for some reason. I was getting a nasty hum on my radio, a PL hum, and I found out that for some reason this repeater is putting out a 141 or 143 PL output. Back to you, Dick.
That's exactly what it should be doing, Steve. To my knowledge, Eric, KE2EJ, made a modification today to add PL to the output. A number of people have been requesting that. They requested a PL in the output because that gives them the ability to set a modern-day receiver such that they will only be hearing signals coming from Frenchtown or signals coming from Torrington, Connecticut, Frenchtown, New Jersey. So a PL was added. You're hearing it. And it was there on purpose. And I believe that on the very first attempt that Eric did this, he had to select a PL different than the input for some crazy reason. Yes, it's going to be a little bit of a problem because some of our rigs don't have quite enough versatility where you can set them for one particular PL encode and another PL decode in the same transceiver, if you know what I mean. Let's see if Eric is on frequency and wants to give us some more words on this one. KE2EJ, if you're there. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Can you hear me?
You're a little bit noisy, but we're hearing you, and I think I'm going to copy you. Go right ahead, Eric.
All right. Yeah, actually, I did that 2 weeks ago. I used a different PL because we have minimized problems, and the output PL, being the same as the input PL, tends to make the input problem worse. So that's why
different PL, but that's the folks who wanted the an output PL, as I warned them, most Japanese radios won't split with the sound. Oh, and for the gentleman up in Maine on Eurojet on 450, 440, there's power restrictions, so consulting your FCC laws, you'll find that you're restricted to 50 watts up there, so be careful. PDRIWK3JET.
Yeah, by those extra hums we're hearing in the background, I can tell that Eric might be at one of the sites of this particular machine. So he did have to choose a different PL tone for the output versus the input to make sure that the machine could not lock up on its own PL, if you know what I mean. And so he said he did that a week or two ago. Also, Eric was saying for the benefit of Lewis is that in certain areas of Maine, there is a power output restriction on 432 because we amateurs on the 432 ham band, as we call it, 420 to 450, we're the secondary users. The primary users are Department of Defense and radio location equipment, radars and things like that. And so if you live near Cape Cod, Massachusetts, for instance, you're not allowed to go above 10 watts. If you live within a certain number of miles of the paved boys radar, and maybe there's a similar requirement in Maine that you'll have to check on there, Lewis. So as you put up the various HFs and VHF antennas, you're going to really like the fact you've got trees, as long as you're able to climb them or use a slingshot to put a line over them in order to support your antennas. Any further questions or comments, Lewis? KB1, Victor Delta Bravo, SLAM 2, K2RIW.
KB1, VDB, slash 2. No, that's great information, Dick. Yeah, I'm excited to have the room to put up antennas. Obviously, it's a bit tricky here in Brooklyn. I have a DHT with a mag mount on the inside of the window. But, yeah, I'm on the west side of the island by the water. So, hopefully I'll be able to, you know, put up a Yagi and get some interesting VHF, UHF coverage back to the mainland. I'll have to check out the power restrictions. I know it was close to Canada. If you're close to Canada, you have some restrictions, but I didn't realize there's also some in-state issues with that, so I'll definitely need to investigate that. Thanks for the info, and back to the net and the next question. Thank you.
Your audio is low. Yeah, if you had a chance, Lou, you might want to either speak louder into the mic or turn up the audio gain on that rig when you get a chance. And if you happen to be at one of the Limark flea markets or get-togethers, and there'll be one coming up in June, I believe, Andy, WA2CDL, gives a free tune-up clinic where he'll set the deviation and the PL tones and whatever for you on that particular rig. When you do put up a rotatable Yagi antenna on any of the VHF frequencies from that particular location where you'll be in what's called Maidenhead Grid Square, number Fox November 54, you will be a popular guy during the VHF contest. You'll be sought after. You'll be popular. They'll treat you very well, and you'll enjoy it quite a bit. So you got a lot of good ham radio up there to look forward to, as I see it, Lou. Come back once in a while by, even when you're back in Maine, come back on either Echo Link or IRLP, in other words, by way of linking your local repeater or by way of the computer hookup, come back and tell us how it's working up there. The next person who signed in was Joe, KC2 Tango Charlie Golf, I think is Joe's call letters. Go right ahead, Joe, wait for the beep first, K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Yes, hi Dick. My name is Joe, and the call again is KC2GZG. And I was wondering when the next meeting was going to be.
Okay, in other words, I guess you're talking about tune-up clinic, or you're talking about the general membership meetings of this particular club. If Rich is available, he's going to tell us both of those. K2KNB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you.
saying maybe Richard's not available right now. The next available club meeting. Huh. I should know, but I don't know. But I know there's going to be a general get-together as far as the flea market is concerned, almost always in June. There was one in February. There'll be another one in June. June or July, but most likely in June. And there's a meeting every month, and I think it's the Tuesday. Can someone tell me, is it the first, second, third Tuesday of the month when the general membership meetings take place? Someone on frequency, please tell me. K2RIW.
Let me meet the ZDX with some corrections.
Mr. ZDX, go right ahead.
Let me meet the ZDX on Tuesday in about 10 years. The second Wednesday of the month, which is this coming Wednesday, this will be a special meeting. It's membership appreciation night with pizza and other refreshments. It will be starting at 7:15. Normally we start at 8 o'clock. So it's 7:15 this Wednesday at Levittown Hall.
And the guy you just heard was V2ZDX, Gerald. And so Jerry tells you Wednesdays, boy, am I in the dark ages when they used to be Tuesdays. So Wednesday, you get free donuts. And Levittown Hall, most likely if you simply go to www.limarc.org, that's the way you'll find out all of this information as I see it, Joe. General meetings, flea markets, the address of the Levittown Hall, how to get there, lots and lots of information. There's probably 15 or 20 pages of information on that website. KC2, Tango Zulu Golf. I'll finally get it right, Joe. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Not a problem, Rich. Thank you very much for the info.
The next person who signed in with a question was Sam, KC2. I think it's Papa Uniform Yankee. Wait for the beep and go right ahead, Sam. K2RIW. And the TechNet.
Hi, Net and Dick. My question concerns quadrature modulation. I just want to ask if we just have a little quick discussion about, you know, QAM and QFSK and so on, because I read something which I may have misinterpreted, that if you have these 90-degree channels, that you could probably reproduce any signal with that 90 degrees. Yeah, I imagine that the resultant vector of the 290s could be used to reproduce any signal. And I just wonder if I misinterpreted that. Go ahead, Dick.
Oh, you're into something reasonably interesting here, Sam. And it's not super easy to understand the first time. But if I was using a digital signal processing receiver, there's a whole lot of advantages when you do that. And my receiver is a normal super heterodyne type receiver. That means the RF amplifier goes into a mixer, the signal goes through the mixer, gets downloaded to a lower IF frequency. And now you have to digitize that signal that's in the IF strip. It's still got its carrier, it's still got its normal modulation, and now you want to thoroughly record the amplitude and phase, amplitude, polarity, and phase at each instant of time as to what that signal is doing. And one of the best ways of doing it is with a in-phase and a quadrature type detector. In other words, you go into a kind of a circuit where there are two output channels from that circuit. One is the in-phase channel, one is the quadrature channel. If I had nothing but a simple amplitude detector, I could tell when the signal is big and small, but I couldn't tell if the signal was slanted in phase 45 degrees to the right or 45 degrees to the left. The signal through a simple amplitude detector would look the same. I'd have an ambiguity. But if I've got a kind of detector that can look at as a polar diagram, I can tell whether or not the signal is up or down. Now, I'm going to call that the in-phase, or whether on that polar diagram the signal is left or right. That's the quadrature signal. You give me those two channels of signal properly digitized and into the right kind of a digital signal processing program. You can now measure spectrum, do filtering, I do all kinds of fancy things. A little bit difficult to understand at first, and the word in phase and quadrature only has meaning with reference to some particular local
repeater. Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
As I was starting to say, it only has meaning with reference to some locally generated reference signal. In other words, if my IF was down to 455 KC, and I had another oscillator at 455 KC, everything in phase would be compared against that, whether it be above the center or below the center, whether it be in phase or an out of phase signal, properly digitized. The 16 QAM signal is another very beautiful thing that's being used on cell phones, among other things. In other words, with one particular carrier, it's possible to have multiple channels of information when you do things like 16 QAM. I'll admit that you have not heard anywhere near enough to make this thoroughly understandable. If you're a little bit confused on some of the stuff I've just given you, Sam, you're in real good company. When you start Googling the right words, in phase and quadrature, or vector demodulator, it's sometimes called a vector demodulator, a circuit that'll give you an in phase and a quadrature signal output. If you also investigate quad amplitude modulation, QAM, all of these things will help. And as I said, at first it's going to be a little bit difficult, but if you're going to be involved with digital signal processing, it's a good thing to make the investment, because it will give you a lot of knowledge as to how the more sophisticated radios are starting to work these days, particularly software-defined radios. KC2, Papa Uniform Yankee, K2RIW. You got it, Sam. Wait for the beep.
Thank you very much. That's exactly where I'm trying to research this information with respect to software-defined radio. And I think we discussed a few weeks ago iPhone application which used quadrature signal, and I think that's where we're headed. I'll do some more research on it, and I thank you for the explanation, and I'll work on it for a while. Thank you again. KC2PUI.
And as you make more discoveries as to how it works, you may have another slant as to a good way of explaining it, Sam. Please come back and tell us what you find, because it's not an easy subject to understand the first few times you hear it. As an engineering student, when it was first explained to me by a professor, wow, it didn't go down easily. It took quite a while for it to all start making some sense. Once I started working on circuits that do radio frequency identification, their in-phase and quadrature detector, a so-called vector demodulator, really makes that circuit work. And it's a so-called zero IF system, which is something that ham radio operators have done from time to time, has some huge advantages in simplicity of circuit and yet very high performance capability. I think I've gone through the list of everyone who signed in with a question. I know that Paul has a space report for us. So before we go to Paul's space report, did I make a mistake of skipping anyone who has signed in up till now with a question? If so, give me your call letters, K2RIW and the TechNet.
KC2WGB.
John recognized, and I think there was a double. Was there another person in there?
Mel, K2KEY.
Mel recognized. Okay, yeah. John first. Go right ahead, John.
Good evening, Dick. Good evening, Mel. Dick, I will wait until after. I just want you to put me on the list. I'll wait for Mel and Paul to be through and then just pick me up then. Thank you very much.
You're on the list, John. Mel, go right ahead.
Okay, if you want a great introduction to DFT, understanding it from, well, as simple as possible, I suggest get the ARRL handbook, and it has a very good explanation of the workings of DFT, plus the comprehensive engineering of it, so you can start, and reread, like you say, the first time you're going to read it.
it is going to look like something that is unbelievable, you know, to understand. But you can, like I say, go over it a number of times, and the only place you're going to find it simply is worth the investment of the ARRL handbook, and on the section of DSP, it's really well covered. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the effort. I have started reading that section, but need a little help. KC2P1.
There are a large number of websites, when you use the right search word, that you'll find that'll help. On top of that, there's an amazing number of radio engineers, you know, with 5, 10, 15, 20 years of service and experience, that when you go to their place of business, sometimes it's hidden a little bit, but on their bookshelf, you'll find the Radio Amateurs Handbook and the ARRL Antenna Book, because these particular books have a fairly simple way of explaining some very complicated things that in other books and other courses you might take, it's presented in a form that's not as user-friendly, if you know what I mean. So there are good places to start. Paul, what's the latest in space? And there's one other thing I want to mention to you, Paul, and that is I'm looking at the February 28th issue of New Yorker, the New Yorker magazine. February 28th issue. On page 22 is an article that goes on for about 8 pages called Vermin of the Sky. Not a very catchy title, but what they're really talking about is near-Earth objects and whether or not NASA has been charged with the responsibility of finding all of these near-Earth objects, predicting on which ones are going to go through the keyhole and hit us. Let me drop.
Okay,
go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I didn't mean to stop you. I just wanted to get by a radio to hear me. One thing that you could, going back to the digital modulation, the way you can express INQ for most people, because what we're really talking about is calculus here, was we consider the in-phase component, the ice component, to be in the time domain, and we consider the quadrant component to be in the frequency domain. And many software-defined radios will actually take a single IF strip, digitize that with an A to B converter, and then do a Hilbert transform on it, take the 0-degree output and the 90-degree output, and then do its processing from that point on. You can do it in the analog domain. It's much easier to do it in the digital domain. That's what I wanted to say. K2RW, K2.
Very fine, Eric. So you're giving us some more of the vocabulary. I've never heard it called the frequency domain and the time domain. On the assumption I've got a real vector demodulator, a polar plotting device, so to speak, and I'm digitizing the I in the Q, I could say that the I is both frequency domain and time domain. I could say the Q is both frequency domain and time domain. So I guess it's a matter of what labels you want to put on it. But to me, that would create a little bit of confusion, but maybe for some people that'll help. But just another way of looking at it. There's lots of ways of looking at these circuits. The way you can get the equivalent of 50 individual tuned circuits, so to speak, in a very small package by way of surface acoustic wave or magnet or bulk acoustic wave devices or digital signal processing. You can make what's called a so-called brick wall filter if you want to. In other words, to really do it with an inductor, a series of inductors and capacitors would fill up a room. And with modern-day circuitry, digital in particular, you can synthesize an extremely large number of equivalent tuned circuits. Once you've got this INQ demodulator and enough resolution on your analog-to-digital converters going into this fancy digital signal processing, there's a lot more to be learned there. I remember Eric was digging into digital signal processing 20 years ago when he and I first met face to face, and I was just hearing those words for the first time. My guess is you've worked with DSP now for 20, 25 solid years. Is that true, Eric?
2MB.
Yeah, well, the funny thing is that when I was working back at Desert, I'll pass a lot of the the computer scientist and the graphic artist that we're doing the thing today, we're using DSP, but we even had